Chapter 7 Langdon shed his bloody hospital gown and wrapped a towel around his waist. After splashing water on his face, he gingerly touched the stitches on the back of his head. The skin was sore, but when he smoothed his matted hair down over the spot, the injury all but disappeared. The caffeine pills were kicking in, and he finally felt the fog beginning to lift. Think, Robert. Try to remember. The windowless bathroom was suddenly feeling claustrophobic, and Langdon stepped into the hall, moving instinctively toward a shaft of natural light that spilled through a partially open door across the corridor. The room was a makeshift study of sorts, with a cheap desk, a worn swivel chair, assorted books on the floor, and, thankfully, a window. Langdon moved toward daylight. In the distance, the rising Tuscan sun was just beginning to kiss the highest spires of the waking city. The Campanile, the Badia, the Bargello. Langdon pressed his forehead to the cool glass. The March air was crisp and cold, amplifying the full spectrum of sunlight that now peaked up over the hillsides. Painter's light, they called it. At the heart of the skyline, a mountainous dome of red tiles rose up, its zenith adorned with a gilt copper ball that glinted like a beacon. Il Duomo. Brunelleschi had made architectural history by engineering the basilica's massive dome, and now, more than 500 years later, the 375-foot-tall structure still stood its ground, an immovable giant on Piazza del Duomo. Why would I be in Florence? For Langdon, a lifelong aficionado of Italian art, Florence had become one of his favorite destinations in all of Europe. This was the city on whose streets Michelangelo played as a child, and in whose studios the Italian Renaissance had ignited. This was Florence, whose galleries lured millions of travelers to admire Botticelli's Birth of Venus, Leonardo's Annunciation, and the city's pride and joy, Il Davide. Langdon had been mesmerized by Michelangelo's David when he first saw it as a teenager, entering the Accademia delle Belle Arti, moving slowly through the somber phalanx of Michelangelo's crude Prigioni, and then feeling his gaze dragged upward, inexorably, to the 17-foot-tall masterpiece. The David's sheer enormity and defined musculature startled most first-time visitors. And yet for Langdon, it had been the genius of David's pose that he found most captivating. Michelangelo had employed the classical tradition of contrapposto to create the illusion that David was leaning to his right, his left leg bearing almost no weight, when, in fact, his left leg was supporting tons of marble. The David had sparked in Langdon his first true appreciation for the power of great sculpture. Now Langdon wondered if he had visited the masterpiece during the last several days. But the only memory he could conjure was that of awakening in the hospital and watching an innocent doctor murdered before his eyes. Very sorry. Very sorry. The guilt he felt was almost nauseating. What have I done? As he stood at the window, his peripheral vision caught a glimpse of a laptop computer sitting on the desk beside him. Whatever had happened to Langdon last night, he suddenly realized, might be in the news. If I can access the internet, I might find answers. Langdon turned toward the doorway and called out, Sienna? Silence. She was still at the neighbor's apartment looking for clothes. Having no doubt Sienna would understand the intrusion, Langdon opened the laptop and powered it up. Sienna's home screen flickered to life, a standard Windows blue cloud background. Langdon immediately went to the Google Italia search page and typed in Robert Langdon. If my students could see me now, he thought as he began the search. Langdon continually admonished his students for Googling themselves, a bizarre new pastime that reflected the obsession with personal celebrity that now seemed to possess American youth. A page of search results materialized, hundreds of hits pertaining to Langdon, his books, and his lectures. Not what I'm looking for, Langdon restricted the search by selecting the news button. A fresh page appeared. News results for Robert Langdon. Book signings. Robert Langdon to appear. Graduation address by Robert Langdon. Robert Langdon publishes symbol primer for... The list was several pages long, and yet Langdon saw nothing recent. Certainly nothing that would explain his current predicament. What happened last night? Langdon pushed on, accessing the website for the Florentine, an English-language newspaper published in Florence. He scanned the headlines, breaking news sections, and police blog, seeing articles on an apartment fire, a government embezzling scandal, and assorted incidents of petty crime. Anything at all? He paused at a breaking news blurb about a city official who, last night, had died of a heart attack in the plaza outside the cathedral. The official's name had yet to be released, but no foul play was suspected. Finally, not knowing what else to do, Langdon logged on to his Harvard email account and checked his messages, wondering if he might find answers there. All he found was the usual stream of mail from colleagues, students, and friends, much of it referencing appointments for the coming week. It's as if nobody knows I'm gone. With rising uncertainty, Langdon shut down the computer and closed the lid. He was about to leave when something caught his eye. On the corner of Sienna's desk, atop a stack of old medical journals and papers, sat a Polaroid photograph. The snapshot was of Sienna Brooks and her bearded doctor colleague, laughing together in a hospital hallway. Dr. Marconi, Langdon thought, racked with guilt as he picked up the photo and studied it. As Langdon replaced the photo on the stack of books, he noticed with surprise the yellow booklet on top, a tattered playbill from the London Globe Theatre. According to the cover, it was for a production of Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, staged nearly 25 years ago. Scrawled across the top of the playbill was a handwritten message in magic marker. Sweetheart, never forget you're a miracle. Langdon picked up the playbill, and a stack of press clippings fell out onto the desk. He quickly tried to replace them, but as he opened the booklet to the weathered page where the clippings had been, he stopped short. He was staring at a cast photo of the child actor portraying Shakespeare's mischievous sprite, Puck. The photo showed a young girl who could not have been more than 5, her blonde hair in a familiar ponytail. The text below her photo read, "A Star is Born." The bio was a gushing account of a child theater prodigy, Sienna Brooks, with an off-the-chart IQ, who had, in a single night, memorized every character's lines and, during initial rehearsals, often cued her fellow cast members. Among this 5-year-old's hobbies were violin, chess, biology, and chemistry. The child of a wealthy couple in the London suburb of Blackheath, the girl was already a celebrity in scientific circles. At the age of 4, she had beat a chess grandmaster at his own game and was reading in 3 languages. My God, Langdon thought. Sienna, that explains a few things. Langdon recalled one of Harvard's most famous graduates had been a child prodigy named Saul Kripke, who at the age of 6 had taught himself Hebrew and read all the works of Descartes by the age of 12. More recently, Langdon recalled reading about a young phenom named Moshe Kai Kavalin, who at age 11 had earned a college degree with a 4.0 grade point average and won a national title in martial arts, and at 14 published a book titled We Can Do. Langdon picked up another press clipping, a newspaper article with a photo of Sienna at age 7. Child genius displays 208 IQ. Langdon had been unaware that IQs even went that high. According to the article, Sienna Brooks was a virtuoso violinist, could master a new language in a month, and was teaching herself anatomy and physiology. He looked at another clipping from a medical journal. The future of thought. Not all minds are created equal. This article had a photo of Sienna, now maybe 10 years old, still a towhead, standing beside a large piece of medical apparatus. The article contained an interview with a doctor, who explained that PET scans of Sienna's cerebellum revealed that it was physically different from other cerebella. In her case, a larger, more streamlined organ, capable of manipulating visual spatial content in ways that most human beings could not begin to fathom. The doctor equated Sienna's physiological advantage to an unusually accelerated cellular growth in her brain, much like a cancer, except that it accelerated growth of beneficial brain tissue rather than dangerous cancer cells. Langdon found a clipping from a small town newspaper. The Curse of Brilliance. There was no photo this time, but the story told of a young genius, Sienna Brooks, who had tried to attend regular schools but was teased by other students because she didn't fit in. It talked about the isolation felt by gifted young people whose social skills could not keep up with their intellects and who were often ostracized. Sienna, according to this article, had run away from home at the age of 8 and had been smart enough to live on her own undiscovered for 10 days. She had been found in an upscale London hotel where she had pretended to be the daughter of a guest, stolen a key, and was ordering room service on someone else's account. Apparently, she had spent the week reading all 1,600 pages of Grey's Anatomy. When authorities asked why she was reading medical texts, she told them she wanted to figure out what was wrong with her brain. Langdon's heart went out to the little girl. He couldn't imagine how lonely it must be for a child to be so profoundly different. He refolded the articles, pausing for one last look at the photo of the 5-year-old Sienna in the role of Puck. Langdon had to admit, considering the surreal quality of his encounter with Sienna this morning, that her role as the mischievous, dream-inducing sprite seemed strangely apt. Langdon only wished that he, like the characters in the play, could now simply wake up and pretend that his most recent experiences were all a dream. Langdon carefully replaced all the clippings on the proper page and closed the playbill, feeling an unexpected melancholy as he again saw the note on the cover. "Sweetheart, never forget you're a miracle." His eyes moved down to the familiar symbol adorning the cover of the playbill. It was the same early Greek pictogram that adorned most playbills around the world, a 2,500-year-old symbol that had become synonymous with dramatic theater, Le Maschere. Langdon looked at the iconic faces of comedy and tragedy gazing up at him, and suddenly he heard a strange humming in his ears, as if a wire were slowly being pulled taut inside his mind. A stab of pain erupted inside his skull. Visions of a mask floated before his eyes. Langdon gasped and raised his hands, sitting down in the desk chair and closing his eyes tightly, clutching at his scalp. In his darkness, the bizarre visions returned with a fury, stark and vivid. The silver-haired woman with the amulet was calling to him again from across a blood-red river. Her shouts of desperation pierced the putrid air, clearly audible over the sounds of the tortured and dying, who thrashed in agony as far as the eye could see. Langdon again saw the upside-down legs adorned with the letter R, the half-buried body peddling its legs in wild desperation in the air. "Seek and find," the woman called to Langdon. "Time is running out." Langdon again felt the overwhelming need to help her, to help everyone. Frantic, he shouted back to her across the blood-red river, "Who are you?" Once again, the woman reached up and lifted her veil to reveal the same striking visage that Langdon had seen earlier.
"I am life," she said.
Without warning, a colossal image materialized in the sky above her, a fearsome mask with a long, beak-like nose and 2 fiery green eyes, which stared blankly out at Langdon.
"And I am death," the voice boomed.
Chapter 8. Langdon's eyes shot open, and he drew a startled breath. He was still seated at Sienna's desk, head in his hands, heart pounding wildly. "What the hell is happening to me?" The images of the silver-haired woman and the beaked mask lingered in his mind. "I am life. I am death." He tried to shake the vision, but it felt seared permanently into his mind. On the desk before him, the playbill's two masks stared up at him. "Your memories will be muddled and uncatalogued," Sienna had told him. "Past, present, and imagination all mixed together." Langdon felt dizzy. Somewhere in the apartment, a phone was ringing. It was a piercing, old-fashioned ring, coming from the kitchen. "Sienna?" Langdon called out, standing up. No response. She had not yet returned. After only two rings, an answering machine picked up.
"Ciao, sono io,"
Sienna's voice happily declared on her outgoing message.
"Lasciatemi un messaggio e vi richiamerò."
There was a beep, and a panicked woman began leaving a message in a thick Eastern European accent. Her voice echoed down the hall.
"Sienna, Istanikova, where are you? It's terrible. Your friend, Dr. Marconi, he dead. Hospital going crazy. Police come here. People telling them you're running out trying to save patient. Why? You don't know him. Now police want to talk to you. They take employee file. I know information wrong. Bad address, no numbers, fake working visa. So they no find you today, but soon they find. I try to warn you. So sorry, Sienna."
The call ended. Langdon felt a fresh wave of remorse engulfing him. From the sounds of the message, Dr. Marconi had been permitting Sienna to work at the hospital. Now Langdon's presence had cost Marconi his life, and Sienna's instinct to save a stranger had dire implications for her future. Just then a door closed loudly at the far end of the apartment.
"She's back."
A moment later the answering machine blared.
"Sienna, it's Danikova. Where are you?"
Langdon winced, knowing what Sienna was about to hear. As the message played, Langdon quickly put away the playbill, neatening the desk. Then he slipped back across the hall into the bathroom, feeling uncomfortable about his glimpse into Sienna's past. 10 seconds later, there was a soft knock on the bathroom door.
"I'll leave your clothes on the doorknob,"
Sienna said, her voice ragged with emotion.
"Thank you so much," Langdon replied.
"When you're done, please come out to the kitchen,"
she added.
"There's something important I need to show you before we call anyone."
Sienna walked tiredly down the hall to the apartment's modest bedroom. Retrieving a pair of blue jeans and a sweater from the dresser, she carried them into her bathroom. Locking her eyes with her own reflection in the mirror, she reached up, grabbed a clutch of her thick blonde ponytail, and pulled down hard, sliding the wig from her bald scalp. A hairless, 32-year-old woman stared back at her from the mirror. Sienna had endured no shortage of challenges in her life, and although she had trained herself to rely on intellect to overcome hardship, her current predicament had shaken her on a deeply emotional level. She set the wig aside and washed her face and hands. After drying off, she changed her clothes and put the wig back on, straightening it carefully. Self-pity was an impulse Sienna seldom tolerated. But now, as the tears welled up from deep within, she knew she had no choice but to let them come. And so she did. She cried for the life she could not control. She cried for the mentor who had died before her eyes. She cried for the profound loneliness that filled her heart. But, above all, she cried for the future, which suddenly felt so uncertain. Chapter 9. Below decks on the luxury vessel the Mendacium, facilitator Lawrence Knowlton sat in his sealed glass cubicle and stared in disbelief at his computer monitor, having just previewed the video their client had left behind. "I'm supposed to upload this to the media tomorrow morning?" In his 10 years with the consortium, Knowlton had performed all kinds of strange tasks that he knew fell somewhere between dishonest and illegal. Working within a moral gray area was commonplace at the consortium, an organization whose lone ethical high ground was that they would do whatever it took to keep a promise to a client. "We follow through. No questions asked. No matter what." The prospect of uploading this video, however, had left Knowlton unsettled. In the past, no matter what bizarre tasks he had performed, He always understood the rationale, grasped the motives, comprehended the desired outcome. And yet this video was baffling. Something about it felt different. Much different. Sitting back down at his computer, Knowlton restarted the video file, hoping a second viewing might shed more light. He turned up the volume and settled in for the 9-minute show. As before, the video began with the soft lapping of water in the eerie, water-filled cabin, where everything was bathed in a numinous red light. Again, the camera plunged down through the surface of the illuminated water to view the silt-covered floor of the cavern. And again, Knowlton read the text on the submerged plaque. In this place, on this date, the world was changed forever. That the polished plaque was signed by the consortium's client was disquieting. That the date was tomorrow left Knowlton increasingly concerned. It was what followed, however, that had truly set Knowlton on edge. The camera now panned to the left to reveal a startling object hovering underwater just beside the plaque. Here, tethered to the floor by a short filament, was an undulating sphere of thin plastic. Delicate and wobbling like an oversized soap bubble, the transparent shape floated like an underwater balloon, inflated not with helium, but with some kind of gelatinous yellow-brown liquid. The amorphous bag was distended and appeared to be about a foot in diameter, and within its transparent walls, the murky cloud of liquid seemed to swirl slowly, like the eye of a silently growing storm. Jesus, Knowlton thought, feeling clammy. The suspended bag looked even more ominous the second time around. Slowly the image faded to black. A new image appeared, the cavern's damp wall dancing with the rippling reflections of the illuminated lagoon. On the wall, a shadow appeared, the shadow of a man, standing in the cavern. But the man's head was misshapen, badly. Instead of a nose, the man had a long beak, as if he were half bird. When he spoke, his voice was muffled, and he spoke with an eerie eloquence. A measured cadence, as if he were the narrator in some kind of classical chorus. Knowlton sat motionless, barely breathing, as the beaked shadow spoke. I am the shade. If you are watching this, then it means my soul is finally at rest. Driven underground, I must speak to the world from deep within the earth. Exiled to this gloomy cavern where the blood-red waters collect in the lagoon that reflects no stars. But this is my paradise, the perfect womb for my fragile child, Inferno. Soon you will know what I have left behind. And yet, even here, I sense the footfalls of the ignorant souls who pursue me. Willing to stop at nothing to thwart my actions. Forgive them, you might say, for they know not what they do. But there comes a moment in history when ignorance is no longer a forgivable offense. A moment when only wisdom has the power to absolve. With purity of conscience, I have bequeathed to you all the gift of hope, of salvation, of tomorrow. And yet still there are those who hunt me like a dog, fueled by the self-righteous belief that I am a madman. There is the silver-haired beauty who dares call me monster. Like the blind clerics who lobbied for the death of Copernicus, she scorns me as a demon, terrified that I have glimpsed the truth. But I am not a prophet. I am your salvation. I am the shade.
Chapter 10.
Have a seat, Sienna said. I have some questions for you.
As Langdon entered the kitchen, he felt much steadier on his feet. He was wearing the neighbor's Brioni suit, which fit remarkably well. Even the loafers were comfortable, and Langdon made a mental note to switch to Italian footwear when he got home.
If I get home, he thought. Sienna was transformed, a natural beauty, having changed into form-fitting jeans and a cream-colored sweater, both of which complemented her lithe figure. Her hair was still pulled back in a ponytail, and without the authoritative air of medical scrubs, she seemed more vulnerable somehow. Langdon noticed her eyes were red, as if she had been crying, and an overwhelming guilt again gripped him. Sienna, I'm so sorry. I heard the phone message. I don't know what to say.
Thanks, she replied. But we need to focus on you at the moment. Please sit down.
Her tone was firmer now, conjuring memories of the articles Langdon had just read about her intellect and precocious childhood.
I need you to think,
Sienna said, motioning for him to sit.
Can you remember how we got to this apartment?
Langdon wasn't sure how it was relevant. In a taxi, he said, sitting down at the table. Someone was shooting at us.
Shooting at you, Professor. Let's be clear on that.
Yes. Sorry.
And do you remember any gunshots while you were in the cab?
Odd question. Yes, two of them. One hit the side mirror and the other broke the rear window.
Good. Now close your eyes.
Langdon realized she was testing his memory. He closed his eyes.
What am I wearing?
Langdon could see her perfectly. Black flats, blue jeans, and a cream V-neck sweater. Your hair is blonde, shoulder length, pulled back. Your eyes are brown. Langdon opened his eyes and studied her, pleased to see his eidetic memory was functioning normally.
Good. Your visual cognitive imprinting is excellent, which confirms your amnesia is fully retrograde, and you have no permanent damage to the memory-making process. Have you recalled anything new from the last few days?
No, unfortunately. I did have another wave of visions while you were gone, though. Langdon told her about the recurrence of his hallucination of the veiled woman, the throngs of dead people, and the writhing, half-buried legs marked with the letter R. Then he told her about the strange, beaked mask hovering in the sky.
I am death? Sienna asked, looking troubled.
That's what it said, yes.
Okay. I guess that beats I am Vishnu, destroyer of worlds.
The young woman had just quoted Robert Oppenheimer at the moment he tested the first atomic bomb.
And this beak-nosed, green-eyed mask?
Sienna said, looking puzzled.
Do you have any idea why your mind might have conjured that image?
No idea at all. But that style of mask was quite common in the Middle Ages. Langdon paused. It's called a plague mask. Sienna looked strangely unnerved.
A plague mask?
Langdon quickly explained that in his world of symbols, the unique shape of the long beaked mask was nearly synonymous with the Black Death, the deadly plague that swept through Europe in the 1300s, killing off a third of the population in some regions. Most believed the black in Black Death was a reference to the darkening of the victim's flesh through gangrene and subepidermal hemorrhages. But in fact, the word black was a reference to the profound emotional dread that the pandemic spread through the population. That long-beaked mask, Langdon said, was worn by medieval plague doctors to keep the pestilence far from their nostrils while treating the infected. Nowadays, you only see them worn as costumes during Venice Carnivale, an eerie reminder of a grim period in Italy's history.
And you're certain you saw one of these masks in your visions?
Sienna asked, her voice now tremulous.
A mask of a medieval plague doctor?
Langdon nodded. A beaked mask is hard to mistake. Sienna was knitting her brow in a way that gave Langdon the sense she was trying to figure out how best to give him some bad news.
And the woman kept telling you to seek and find?
Yes, just as before. But the problem is, I have no idea what I'm supposed to seek. Sienna let out a long, slow breath, her expression grave.
I think I may know. And what's more, I think you may have already found it.
Langdon stared. What are you talking about?
Robert, last night when you arrived at the hospital, You were carrying something unusual in your jacket pocket. Do you recall what it was?
Langdon shook his head.
You were carrying an object, a rather startling object. I found it by chance when we were cleaning you up.
She motioned to Langdon's bloody Harris tweed, which was laid out flat on the table.
It's still in the pocket, if you'd like to have a look.
Uncertain, Langdon eyed his jacket. At least that explains why she went back for my jacket. He grabbed his blood-stained coat and searched all the pockets, one by one. Nothing. He did it again. Finally, he turned to her with a shrug. There's nothing here.
How about the secret pocket?
What? My jacket doesn't have a secret pocket.
No?
She looked puzzled.
Then, is this jacket someone else's?
Langdon's brain felt muddled again. No, this is my jacket.
You're certain?
Damn certain, he thought. In fact, it used to be my favorite Camberley. He folded back the lining and showed Sienna the label bearing his favorite symbol in the fashion world. Harris Tweed's iconic orb adorned with 13 button-like jewels and topped by a Maltese cross. Leave it to the Scots to invoke the Christian warriors on a piece of twill. Look at this, Langdon said, pointing out the hand-embroidered initials, RL, that had been added to the label. He always sprang for Harris Tweed's hand-tailored models, and for that reason, he always paid extra to have them sew his initials into the label. On a college campus where hundreds of tweed jackets were constantly doffed and donned in dining halls and classrooms, Langdon had no intention of getting the short end of an inadvertent trade.
I believe you, she said, taking the jacket from him. Now, you look.
Sienna opened the jacket farther to reveal the lining near the nape of the back. Here, discreetly hidden in the lining, was a large, neatly fashioned pocket.
What the hell?
Langdon was certain he had never seen this before. The pocket consisted of a hidden seam, perfectly tailored.
That wasn't there before, Langdon insisted.
Then I'm imagining you've never seen this?
Sienna reached into the pocket and extracted a sleek metal object, which she set gently in Langdon's hands. Langdon stared down at the object in utter bewilderment.
Do you know what this is?
Sienna asked.
No,
he stammered. I've never seen anything like it.
Well, unfortunately, I do know what this is, and I'm fairly certain it's the reason someone is trying to kill you.
Now, pacing his private cubicle aboard the Mendacium, Facilitator Knowlton felt an increasing disquiet as he considered the video he was supposed to share with the world tomorrow morning.
I am the Shade?
Rumors had circulated that this particular client had suffered a psychotic break over the last few months, but this video seemed to confirm those rumors beyond any doubt. Knowlton knew he had two choices. He could either prepare the video for delivery tomorrow, as promised, or he could take it upstairs to the provost for a second opinion.
I already know his opinion, Knowlton thought,
having never witnessed the provost take any action other than the one promised a client. He'll tell me to upload this video to the world, no questions asked, and he'll be furious at me for asking. Knowlton returned his attention to the video, which he rewound to a particularly unsettling spot. He started the playback, and the eerily illuminated cavern reappeared accompanied by the sounds of lapping water. The humanoid shadow loomed on the dripping wall, a tall man with a long, bird-like beak. In a muffled voice, the deformed shadow spoke.
These are the new Dark Ages. Centuries ago, Europe was in the depths of its own misery, the population huddled, starving, mired in sin and hopelessness. They were as a congested forest, suffocated by dead wood, awaiting God's lightning strike. The spark that would finally ignite the fire that would rage across the land and clear the dead wood, once again bringing sunshine to the healthy roots. Culling is God's natural order. Ask yourself, what followed the Black Death? We all know the answer. The Renaissance. Rebirth. It has always been this way. Death is followed by birth. To reach paradise, man must pass through inferno. This the master taught us. And yet this silver-haired ignorant dares call me monster? Does she still not grasp the mathematics of the future, the horrors it will bring? I am the shade. I am your salvation. And so I stand deep within this cavern, gazing out across the lagoon that reflects no stars. Here, in this sunken palace, inferno smolders beneath the waters. Soon, it will burst into flames. And when it does, nothing on earth will be able to stop it.
Chapter 11. The object in Langdon's hand felt surprisingly heavy for its size. Slender and smooth, the polished metal cylinder was about 6 inches long and rounded at both ends, like a miniature torpedo.
"Before you handle that too roughly," Sienna offered, "you may want to look at the other side."
She gave him a taut smile.
"You say you're a professor of symbols?"
Langdon refocused on the tube, turning it in his hands until a bright red symbol rolled into view, emblazoned on its side. Instantly, his body tensed. As a student of iconography, Langdon knew that precious few images had the power to instill instantaneous fear in the human mind. But the symbol before him definitely made the list. His reaction was visceral and immediate. He placed the tube on the table and slid back his chair. Sienna nodded.
"Yeah, that was my reaction, too."
The marking on the tube was a simple trilateral icon. This notorious symbol, Langdon had once read, was developed by Dow Chemical in the 1960s to replace an array of impotent warning graphics previously in use. Like all successful symbols, this one was simple, distinctive, and easy to reproduce. Cleverly conjuring associations with everything from crab pincers to ninja hurling knives, the modern biohazard symbol had become a global brand that conveyed danger in every language.
"This little canister is a biotube," Sienna said, "used for transporting dangerous substances. We see these occasionally in the medical field. Inside is a foam sleeve into which you can insert a specimen tube for safe transport. In this case," she pointed to the biohazard symbol, "I'm guessing a deadly chemical agent, or maybe a virus?"
She paused.
"The first Ebola samples were brought back from Africa in a tube similar to this one."
This was not at all what Langdon wanted to hear. "What the hell is it doing in my jacket? I'm an art history professor. Why am I carrying this thing?" Violent images of writhing bodies flashed through his mind, and hovering over them, the plague mask.
"Very sorry. Very sorry. Wherever this came from," Sienna said, "this is a very high-end unit. Lead-lined titanium. Virtually impenetrable, even to radiation. I'm guessing government issue."
She pointed to a postage-stamp-size black pad flanking the biohazard symbol.
"Thumbprint recognition. Security in case it's lost or stolen. Tubes like this can be opened only by a specified individual."
Although Langdon sensed his mind now working at normal speed, he still felt as if he were struggling to catch up.
"I've been carrying a biometrically sealed canister. When I discovered this canister in your jacket, I wanted to show Dr. Marconi privately, but I didn't have an opportunity before you woke up. I considered trying your thumb on the pad while you were unconscious, but I had no idea what was in the tube, and..."
"My thumb?" Langdon shook his head. "There's no way this thing is programmed for me to open it. I don't know anything about biochemistry. I'd never have anything like this."
"Are you sure?"
Langdon was damned sure. He reached out and placed his thumb on the finger pad. Nothing happened. "See? I told..." The titanium tube clicked loudly, and Langdon yanked his hand back as if it had been burned.
"Holy shit."
He stared at the canister as if it were about to unscrew itself and start emitting a deadly gas. After 3 seconds, it clicked again, apparently relocking itself. Speechless, Langdon turned to Sienna. The young doctor exhaled, looking unnerved.
Well, it seems pretty clear that the intended carrier is you.
For Langdon, the entire scenario felt incongruous. That's impossible. First of all, how would I get this chunk of metal through airport security?
Maybe you flew in on a private jet. Or maybe it was given to you when you arrived in Italy.
Sienna, I need to call the consulate. Right away.
You don't think we should open it first?
Langdon had taken some ill-advised actions in his life, but opening a hazardous materials container in this woman's kitchen would not be one of them. I'm handing this thing over to the authorities, now. Sienna pursed her lips, mulling over options.
Okay, but as soon as you make that call, you're on your own. I can't be involved. You definitely can't meet them here. My immigration situation in Italy is complicated.
Langdon looked Sienna in the eye. All I know, Sienna, is that you saved my life. I'll handle this situation however you want me to handle it. She gave a grateful nod and walked over to the window, gazing down at the street below.
Okay. This is how we should do it.
Sienna quickly outlined a plan. It was simple, clever, and safe. Langdon waited as she turned on her cell phone's caller ID blocking and dialed. Her fingers were delicate and yet moved purposefully.
Informazioni abbonati?
Sienna said, speaking in a flawless Italian accent.
Per favore, può darmi il numero del consolato americano di Firenze?
She waited, and then quickly wrote down a phone number.
Grazie mille,
she said, and hung up. Sienna slid the phone number over to Langdon, along with her cell phone.
You're on. Do you remember what to say?
My memory is fine, he said with a smile as he dialed the number on the slip of paper. The line began to ring. Here goes nothing. He switched the call to speaker and set the phone on the table so Sienna could hear. A recorded message answered, offering general information about consulate services and hours of operation, which did not begin until 8:30 a.m. Langdon checked the clock on the cell. It was only 6 a.m. If this is an emergency, the automated recording said, you may dial 77 to speak to the night duty officer. Langdon immediately dialed the extension. The line was ringing again.
Consolato Americano,
a tired voice answered.
Sono il funzionario di turno. Lei parla inglese?
Langdon asked. Of course, the man said in American English. He sounded vaguely annoyed to have been awoken.
How can I help you?
I'm an American visiting Florence, and I was attacked. My name is Robert Langdon.
Passport number, please.
The man yawned audibly. My passport is missing. I think it was stolen. I was shot in the head. I've been in the hospital. I need help. The attendant suddenly woke up.
Sir, did you say you were shot? What was your full name again, please?
Robert Langdon. There was a rustling on the line, and then Langdon could hear the man's fingers typing on a keyboard. The computer pinged. A pause. Then more fingers on the keyboard. Another ping. Then three high-pitched pings. A longer pause.
Sir, the man said, your name is Robert Langdon?
Yes, that's right, and I'm in trouble.
Okay, sir, your name has an action flag on it, which is directing me to transfer you immediately to the Consul General's chief administrator.
The man paused, as if he himself couldn't believe it. Just hold the line.
Wait, can you tell me?
The line was already ringing. It rang four times and connected.
This is Collins,
a hoarse voice answered. Langdon took a deep breath and spoke as calmly and clearly as possible.
Mr. Collins, my name is Robert Langdon. I'm an American visiting Florence. I've been shot. I need help. I want to come to the U.S. consulate immediately. Can you help me?
Without hesitation, the deep voice replied,
Thank heavens you're alive, Mr. Langdon. We've been looking for you.
Chapter 12.
The consulate knows I'm here?
For Langdon, the news brought an instantaneous flood of relief. Mr. Collins, who had introduced himself as the Consul General's chief administrator, spoke with a firm, professional cadence, and yet there was urgency in his voice.
Mr. Langdon, you and I need to speak immediately, and obviously not on the phone.
Nothing was obvious to Langdon at this point, but he wasn't about to interrupt.
I'll have someone pick you up right away,
Collins said.
What is your location?
Sienna shifted nervously, listening to the interchange on speakerphone. Langdon gave her a reassuring nod, fully intending to follow her plan exactly. I'm in a small hotel called Pensione La Fiorentina, Langdon said, glancing across the street at the drab hotel that Sienna had pointed out moments ago. He gave Collins the street address.
Got it,
the man replied.
Don't move. Stay in your room. Someone will be there right away. Room number?
Langdon made one up. 39.
Okay. 20 minutes.
Collins lowered his voice.
And Mr. Langdon, it sounds like you may be injured and confused. But I need to know. Are you still in possession?
In possession? Langdon sensed the question, while cryptic, could have only one meaning. His eyes moved to the biotube on the kitchen table. Yes, sir. I'm still in possession. Collins exhaled audibly.
When we didn't hear from you, we assumed... Well, frankly, we assumed the worst. I'm relieved. Stay where you are. Don't move. 20 minutes. Someone will knock on your door.
Collins hung up. Langdon could feel his shoulders relaxing for the first time since he'd woken up in the hospital. The consulate knows what's going on, and soon I'll have answers. Langdon closed his eyes and let out a slow breath, feeling almost human now. His headache had all but passed.
Well, that was all very MI6, Sienna said in a half-joking tone. Are you a spy?
At the moment, Langdon had no idea what he was. The notion that he could lose 2 days of memory and find himself in an unrecognizable situation felt incomprehensible. And yet, here he was, 20 minutes away from a rendezvous with a U.S. consulate official in a rundown hotel.
What's happening here?
He glanced over at Sienna, realizing they were about to part ways and yet feeling as if they had unfinished business. He pictured the bearded doctor at the hospital, dying on the floor before her eyes.
Sienna, he whispered. Your friend, Dr. Marconi, I feel terrible.
She nodded blankly.
And I'm sorry to have dragged you into this. I know your situation at the hospital is unusual. And if there's an investigation...
He trailed off.
It's okay, she said. I'm no stranger to moving around.
Langdon sensed in Sienna's distant eyes that everything had changed for her this morning. Langdon's own life was in chaos at the moment, and yet he felt his heart going out to this woman. She saved my life, and I've ruined hers. They sat in silence for a full minute, the air between them growing heavy, as if they both wanted to speak, and yet had nothing to say. They were strangers, after all, on a brief and bizarre journey that had just reached a fork in the road, each of them now needing to find separate paths.
Sienna, Langdon finally said, when I sort this out with the consulate, if there's anything I can do to help you, please.
Thanks,
she whispered, and turned her eyes sadly toward the window. As the minutes ticked past, Sienna Brooks gazed absently out the kitchen window and wondered where the day would lead her. Wherever it was, she had no doubt that by day's end, her world would look a lot different. She knew it was probably just the adrenaline, but she found herself strangely attracted to the American professor. In addition to his being handsome, he seemed to possess a sincerely good heart. In some distant, alternate life, Robert Langdon might even be someone she could be with.
He would never want me, she thought. I'm damaged.
As she choked back the emotion, something outside the window caught her eye. She bolted upright, pressing her face to the glass and staring down into the street.
Robert, look!
Langdon peered down into the street at the sleek, black BMW motorcycle that had just rumbled to a stop in front of Pensione La Fiorentina. The driver was lean and strong, wearing a black leather suit and helmet. As the driver gracefully swung off the bike and removed a polished black helmet, Sienna could hear Langdon stop breathing. The woman's spiked hair was unmistakable. She produced a familiar handgun, checked the silencer, and slid it back inside her jacket pocket. Then, moving with lethal grace, she slipped inside the hotel.
"Robert?"
Sienna whispered, her voice taut with fear.
"The U.S. government just sent someone to kill you."
Chapter 13. Robert Langdon felt a swell of panic as he stood at the apartment window, eyes riveted on the hotel across the street. The spike-haired woman had just entered, but Langdon could not fathom how she had gotten the address. Adrenaline coursed through his system, disjointing his thought process once again. "My own government sent someone to kill me?" Sienna looked equally astounded.
"Robert, that means the original attempt on your life at the hospital was also sanctioned by your government."
She got up and double-checked the lock on the apartment door.
"If the U.S. consulate has permission to kill you..."
She didn't finish the thought, but she didn't have to. The implications were terrifying. "What the hell do they think I did? Why is my own government hunting me?" Once again, Langdon heard the two words he had apparently been mumbling when he staggered into the hospital. "Very sorry. Very sorry."
"You're not safe here," Sienna said. "We're not safe here."
She motioned across the street.
"That woman saw us flee the hospital together, and I'm betting your government and the police are already trying to track me down. My apartment is a sublet in someone else's name, but they'll find me eventually."
She turned her attention to the biotube on the table.
"You need to open that right now."
Langdon eyed the titanium device, seeing only the biohazard symbol.
"Whatever's inside that tube," Sienna said, "probably has an ID code, an agency sticker, a phone number, something. You need information. I need information. Your government killed my friend."
The pain in Sienna's voice shook Langdon from his thoughts, and he nodded, knowing she was correct.
"Yes, I'm very sorry."
Langdon cringed, hearing those words again. He turned to the canister on the table, wondering what answers might be hidden inside. It could be incredibly dangerous to open this. Sienna thought for a moment.
"Whatever's inside will be exceptionally well contained, probably in a shatterproof plexiglass test tube. This biotube is just an outer shell to provide additional security during transport."
Langdon looked out the window at the black motorcycle parked in front of the hotel. The woman had not yet come out, but she would soon figure out that Langdon was not there. He wondered what her next move would be, and how long it would take before she was pounding on the apartment door. Langdon made up his mind. He lifted the titanium tube and reluctantly placed his thumb on the biometric pad. After a moment, the canister pinged, and then clicked loudly. Before the tube could lock itself again, Langdon twisted the two halves against each other in opposite directions. After a quarter turn, the canister pinged a second time, and Langdon knew he was committed. Langdon's hands felt sweaty as he continued unscrewing the tube. The two halves turned smoothly on perfectly machined threads. He kept twisting, feeling as if he were about to open a precious Russian nesting doll, except that he had no idea what might fall out. After five turns, the two halves released. With a deep breath, Langdon gently pulled them apart. The gap between the halves widened, and a foam rubber interior slid out. Langdon laid it on the table. The protective padding vaguely resembled an elongated Nerf football.
"Here goes nothing."
Langdon gently folded back the top of the protective foam, finally revealing the object nestled inside. Sienna stared down at the contents and cocked her head, looking puzzled.
"Definitely not what I expected."
Langdon had anticipated some kind of futuristic-looking vial, but the content of the biotube was anything but modern. The ornately carved object appeared to be made of ivory and was approximately the size of a roll of lifesavers.
It looks old, Sienna whispered. Some kind of...
cylinder seal, Langdon told her, finally permitting himself to exhale. Invented by the Sumerians in 3500 BC, cylinder seals were the precursors to the intaglio form of printmaking. Carved with decorative images, a seal contained a hollow shaft through which an axle pin was inserted so the carved drum could be rolled like a modern paint roller across wet clay or terracotta to imprint a recurring band of symbols, images, or text. This particular seal, Langdon guessed, was undoubtedly quite rare and valuable, and yet he still couldn't imagine why it would be locked in a titanium canister like some kind of bioweapon. As Langdon delicately turned the seal in his fingers, he realized that this one bore an especially gruesome carving. A three-headed, horned Satan who was in the process of eating three different men at once, one man in each of his three mouths. Pleasant. Langdon's eyes moved to seven letters carved beneath the devil. The ornate calligraphy was written in mirror image, as was all text on imprinting rollers, but Langdon had no trouble reading the letters. Saligia. Sienna squinted at the text, reading it aloud.
Saligia?
Langdon nodded, feeling a chill to hear the word spoken aloud. It's a Latin mnemonic invented by the Vatican in the Middle Ages to remind Christians of the seven deadly sins. Saligia is an acronym for superbia, avaricia, luxuria, invidia, gula, ira, and acedia. Sienna frowned.
Pride, greed, lust, envy, gluttony, wrath, and sloth.
Langdon was impressed. You know Latin.
I grew up Catholic. I know sin.
Langdon managed a smile as he returned his gaze to the seal, wondering again why it had been locked in a biotube as if it were dangerous.
I thought it was ivory, Sienna said. But it's bone.
She slid the artifact into the sunlight and pointed to the lines on it.
Ivory forms in a diamond-shaped cross-hatching with translucent striations. Bones form with these parallel striations and darkened pitting.
Langdon gently picked up the seal and examined the carvings more closely. The original Sumerian seals had been carved with rudimentary figures and cuneiform. This seal, however, was much more elaborately carved. Medieval, Langdon guessed. Furthermore, the embellishments suggested an unsettling connection with his hallucinations. Sienna eyed him with concern.
What is it?
Recurring theme, Langdon said grimly, and motioned to one of the carvings on the seal. See this three-headed man-eating Satan? It's a common image from the Middle Ages, an icon associated with the Black Death. The three gnashing mouths are symbolic of how efficiently the plague ate through the population. Sienna glanced uneasily at the biohazard symbol on the tube. Allusions to the plague seemed to be occurring with more frequency this morning than Langdon cared to admit, and so it was with reluctance that he acknowledged a further connection. Saligia is representative of the collective sins of mankind, which, according to medieval religious indoctrination,
was the reason God punished the world with the Black Death,
Sienna said, completing his thought.
Yes.
Langdon paused, momentarily losing his train of thought. He had just noticed something about the cylinder that struck him as odd. Normally, a person could peer through a cylinder seal's hollow center, as if through a section of empty pipe. But in this case, the shaft was blocked. There's something inserted inside this bone. The end caught the light and shimmered. There's something inside, Langdon said, and it looks like it's made of glass. He flipped the cylinder seal upside down to check the other end, and as he did so, a tiny object rattled inside, tumbling from one end of the bone to the other, like a ball bearing in a tube. Langdon froze, and he heard Sienna let out a soft gasp beside him.
What the hell was that? Did you hear that sound?
Sienna whispered. Langdon nodded and carefully peered into the end of the canister. The opening appears to be blocked by something made of metal. Cap of a test tube, maybe? Sienna backed away.
Does it look broken?
I don't think so. He carefully tipped the bone again to re-examine the glass end, and the rattling sound recurred. An instant later, the glass in the cylinder did something wholly unexpected. It began to glow. Sienna's eyes opened wide.
Robert, stop! Don't move!